Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Professor Greg Craven and Anne Henderson make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute, this time on the occasion of the publication of Anne Henderson's book, Federation's Man of Letters, Patrick McMahon Glynn, which is published by the PM Glynn Institute, which is part of the Australian Catholic University. So our speakers are very well known tonight. I'll introduce them briefly. Professor Greg Craven is an author, but most particularly Vice-Chancellor and President of the Australian Catholic University. And Anne Henderson, of course, is the Deputy Director of the Sydney Institute and a visiting fellow of the PM Glynn Institute at the Australian Catholic University. And our speakers tonight are discussing the broad topic of remembering Patrick McMahon Glynn. Welcome Greg Craven, who will be followed by Anne Henderson.
As a professionally guilt-ridden Catholic, I revel in my sins, thank you. But I'm constantly surprised by my sins of omission, the ones of commission I'm readily aware of. And I really thought of this in reading Anne's book, because I could have sworn that if you'd gone to the index of the last book I wrote and probably ever will write, Conversations with the Constitution, or tracked down the transcript of my Senate lecture, the Founding Fathers, Constitutional Kings or Colonial Knaves, you would have found glowing references to Patrick McMahon Glynn. At the age of 25, 26, I was enough of an idiot to convince the government to fund the republication of the convention debates, complete with an index and a guide to each provision, which I wrote myself, which meant I have read all six volumes of the convention debates. And I am the last person to personally know the Founding Fathers, because I followed them through. And I have to say that Patrick McMahon Glynn, and it will become apparent why, was one of my favourite constitutional characters. But alas, there is no reference to Patrick McMahon Glynn either in the book or the lecture. And when you think about it, it's quite significant that a Catholic constitutional lawyer could pass over Glynn. It's a reminder of just how forgettable he's become. And that's truly ironic, because there is every reason not to forget him. So it's a bit of a delight, really, to be here to launch Anne Henderson's Federation's Man of Letters, because if it fulfils only one purpose, it's to remind us why Glynn actually was unforgettable, even if we have forgotten him until now. Before entering Parliament, Glynn was a lawyer. Now, it's an old joke, Dr. Johnson, I would not say ill of any man, but I believe he was a solicitor. Glynn was not an ordinary lawyer. He wasn't a narrow-minded legal draftsman. He was, in fact, a polymath. Like so many of the Founding Father generation, he was a self-taught intellectual. He was knowledgeable, indeed volubly wise, indeed endlessly and somewhat irritatingly wise about all manner of things. And there's something that's just valuable in itself, but I always think looking back on the Founding Fathers assumes a further significance when it's juxtaposed with our current crop of politicians who have succeeded Glynn in Parliament. Because what becomes apparent from Anne Henderson's essay is that Glynn is patently interesting, learned, intellectual, and charming. And these are not adjectives typically applied to contemporary politicians in Australia, or indeed elsewhere. He was also funny and eccentric. And I am a great believer in funniness, a great believer in eccentricity, and a great believer in the two combined. It strikes me forcibly that today's politicians, no matter how hard they try, just can't pull this off. You don't find humour accompanying eccentricity in public life anymore. What we have in our politicians is, frankly, a relatively boring group of technicians, by which I mean their relatives are probably also boring too. They aren't interested in being polymaths. They are positively uninterested in being learned. Most of you would know that to try and have a conversation at a dinner party attended by today's political class, you will find that on most occasions the attendees will struggle to sustain an interesting or thoughtful conversation about anything but politics. Now, at least outside New South Wales we can talk about football, but it's particularly difficult in Sydney. There's a certain drabness to them. They all look the same. It's almost interchangeable. And it's stating the obvious to say that Paddy Glynn didn't look the same as other politicians. He dressed differently from today's politicians. But the interesting thing about the way he dressed was, even in his day, he demonstrated an individuality of style that is unusual in politicians, or at least male politicians today. He not only dressed someone differently, he talked differently. His Irish brogue was famous. Was sometimes said he was deployed on occasions in the constitutional conventions, not for positions where his oratory would be clear, but precisely for positions where his oratory would make it utterly unclear what the convention was actually voting. Now, I don't think he ever approached the point of Joseph Chamberlain, whose orchid buttonholes were the delight of the House of Commons when he got up to address them. But he was an eccentric, funny, clever man. He's also a remarkable man. And the thing I think here that is fundamentally important is that he exemplifies a remarkable generation. The founding fathers really do represent an exceptional generation in Australia. They were, and this is what I've always thought about them, the distinction between them and their successors. The founding fathers, including Glynn, were elected to public office and particularly to the constitutional conventions because they were already deemed to be important. They were the best there were, in contrast with today's political class, stark contrast, where they are deemed to be important only because they happen to have been elected. And outside the political class, their importance diminishes correspondingly. And when they leave political life, it is notable that very few come out undiminished and many vanish beneath the waves of reality without a trace. Now, in 1965, Father Gerard Glynn O'Collins did us a great service by writing the standard biography of his grandfather, Patrick McMahon Glynn. Now, Anne hasn't tried to repeat that. What she's done, though, is provided a shorter essay-length appreciation of Glynn, and she's really done a sterling job of distilling much of what matters most about Glynn and his generation. Now, of course, it's a book that reminds you of achievements, but it also reveals something of the interesting and quirky character that he has. It leaves you sort of wishing that you could have found and conversed late on in the life on any topic that you cared to name, because he had an opinion on just about everything, from Shakespeare to the Murray River to the fairies of what I may say are our common ancestral county of Galway, and they really do exist, horses and the mysteries of the transcendent. There was no topic upon which Patrick McMahon Glynn could not converse, interestingly and at great length. I think Anne Henderson also demonstrates the sense in which Glynn belonged, frankly, to a better age in public life. He was an impressive and unique individual, but in everything he did, he demonstrates what we almost are determined to forget, that extraordinary flowering of Western civilization that was manifested in the Australian colonies at the close of the 19th century. that produced achievements where basically colonial drafters of legislation, many of whom were in theory amateurs, were able to draft a bill that was accepted virtually without change by the Mother of Parliaments. The Australian Constitution is very much an Australian document, unlike, for example, the British North America of Canada. And watching Brexit, you know, watching the suicide of empire, as I some might call it, I say to my British friends, yeah, can you imagine what would be happening, how much better your position would be if Brexit was being done by the Australian Federation generation? And can I imagine how much worse our position would be if Federation had been done by the Brexit generation? Imagining David Cameron as Alfred Deakin is a gruesome possibility. Glyn, I think, exemplified a lot of things. He exemplified a really thoughtful Irishman in Australia, which is a particular thing. He was one of those many Irish Australians whose support for the Crown was unambiguous, but on the other hand, rejoiced in the idea that Australia had achieved a republic under the Crown, and did so more than a century before that latter-day Scott Ulsterman here, but I will say Irishman Michael Kirby, declared Australia to be a crowned republic, appropriating Badgett's description of the constitutional monarchy. And at the same time, Glyn favoured independence under the crown. Glyn was a man of nuance. It's interesting, I've often reflected with him. My own great-great-grandfather, a man who rejoiced in the name in Galway of Tardy O'Creevan, and got off the boat in Geelong and was told that his name was Timothy Craven, fled repression and poverty of the empire to find protection of laws and opportunity in the empire. It's that great paradox, I think, the Irish paradox of empire. I've never discussed it with Thomas Keneally, and I don't plan to. Anne's essay is a significant asset in its own right, and I'm sure it's going to help a whole new generation of people to become familiar with Federation's Man of Letters. But it's published also with five responses, and I should acknowledge the further contributions they make. Patrick Mullins situates this biographical essay in a venerable tradition, stretching back from Geoffrey Bolton, who I was privileged to know, to Virginia Woolf, Lytton Strachey, and ultimately to Pluto, a reminder that Henderson's reflections on Glyn's life are as much an expression of Western civilization as Glyn's life and work itself. This is a long-established tradition. Anne Toomey has delved more deeply into Glyn's legacy as a lawyer, both in terms of his contribution to drafting the Constitution and as an Attorney General, and she tests the claims he's a liberal and or a conservative, as well as the influence of Catholicism. Suzanne Rutland provides a useful comparison between the experiences of Glyn as a Catholic and Sir Isaac Isaacs as a Jew among the Protestant ascendancy of the Federation generation, who, for all their brilliance, were plagued by prejudice. I can tell you, as I say, as the last man who personally knew the Founding Fathers, read every single thing they said, there was one clear difference between Patrick McMahon Glyn and Isaac Isaacs. One was that Patrick McMahon Glyn was a liked and likeable man, and no one ever said that of Isaac Isaacs. Peter Boyce offers some telling reflections on the attitudes of Anglican elites in Glyn's day and traces their fortunes up until our own day, which are quite different, regal experience of prejudices. And finally, ACU's own Chancellor John Fay, may I say, yet another person from a Galway family. Craven, Glyn and Fay are all Galway names, although Craven and Fay come from 2 miles apart and poor Patrick McMahon came from Gort. And if any of you have ever been to Gort, I know that you're not going back. I have been to Gort. And the Chancellor points out that Glyn is a real model of public service informed by Catholic social teaching, even when one is not what Fay would describe as a prominent public Catholic. And he also admits, much to his horror, that it was only in the most recent times that he learnt anything of substance about Glyn's life and legacy. So it consoles a vice chancellor to know that his sins of omission are no worse than his chancellor, and I may say that my sins of commission are less. I at least had the decency to be born in Melbourne. And it also consoles me. It's a pity he wasn't here. Someone will tell him, though. It'll get back to him. And it also consoles me to know that the book we're launching today will leave no excuse for his successors to commit any sins of omission so far as the legacy of Patrick McMahon Glyn is concerned. So I commend the book, and I commend the author, and I rejoice in the memory of its subject. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Probably one of the reasons why we're all here is that Greg and his sin of omission has been made good by the fact that he's started up the PM Glyn Institute at the Australian Catholic University, and I don't think we're going to forget Patrick McMahon Glyn for much longer. This is a little example of what the cartoonist thought of Glyn. You can have a look at it in your flyer. Tonight we're celebrating the life of Patrick McMahon Glyn, one of Australia's founding fathers, as you've heard, an early federal government MP and minister, a founding father who was born in Ireland, spent much of his working life in Melbourne, and hailed from South Australia. Yet don't despair. Paddy Glyn has one important connection to Sydney. For it was in Sydney in 1897, during the second of the conventions to design the constitution, which would be put to the British Parliament for a federation of the Australian colonies, that Patrick McMahon Glyn, age 42, proposed by letter on Tuesday the 7th of September, to be precise, to a Miss Abigail Dynan who lived in Melbourne. Paddy Glyn and Miss Dynan had met just once, some 2 years before. She obviously remembered Glyn fondly from that one meeting because she replied almost immediately. And postal deliveries were a lot quicker in those days. So when Miss Dynan accepted by telegram virtually the next day, Glyn booked his overnight train for Friday, and they were married in Melbourne on the Saturday, the 11th of September, with King O'Malley as best man. The Glyns thus spent their honeymoon in Sydney, there's a connection, attending a long list of official engagements until the end of the convention on the 24th of September. In classic PM Glyn style, he being an addicted reader, there was a report which his granddaughter Maeve Collins recalled that it was reported from one outing for the delegates that Glyn was found reading in one train carriage while his pretty young wife was happily chatting to others in another. As marriages go, in spite of its unique beginnings, it was a very successful union, producing 8 children, 6 of whom grew to adulthood. Now, Sir Robert Menzies, in the 60s, commenting on Patrick McMahon Glyn, obviously someone hadn't forgotten him, whom he came to know as a barrister appearing before the High Court sitting in Melbourne, described Glyn as looking like a black beetle and talking like a silver-tongued angel. Whatever one said about his Irish brogue being at times hard to understand, he was an avid speaker at lectures where he was invited again and again, and obviously something about that brogue charmed his audiences. He was a well-loved, attractive individual. Cartoonists and journalists found him to have the colourful character for portraiture, especially in print. His small physique was like a jockey, his thick Irish accent, his bushy moustache and his somewhat tweedy attire. But cartoonists very often drew him with an oversized head, the head of a man of letters, whose erudition captured attention. For in his wide reading of the classics and political philosophers, Paddy Glyn saw beyond the immediate in ways that a century later have resonance. On the 18th of February, 1898, he wrote in Sydney's Australian Star that we cannot shut our eyes to the fact that the theatre of the world's struggle is being shifted from west to east. The time may come when England will tell us that she has other duties to which she must subordinate the defence of Australia, and ask her, Australia, to herself secure her standing in the councils of Eastern Asia, a la 1939. Paddy Glyn could also plough through tough negotiations, as in the Murray Rivers Agreement, which took over 2 decades, and here he extracted practical outcomes from conciliation and compromise. In the political times of Patrick Manglin, bigotry and prejudice abounded, as it does in our own today. But it was Glidden's way, however, not to revolt or agitate against his opponents. He preferred to remain strong in the face of debate, while seeking, wherever possible, to meet halfway, or at least strive for reasoned understanding. In this, Glynn has many messages for contemporary life. Patrick McMahon-Glynn made his way to Australia from Ireland in 1880, leaving Plymouth on the 4th of September. He was 25. An article clerk in Dublin, a graduate of Trinity College Dublin, and a student of the law at Middle Temple in London, Patrick McMahon-Glynn was taking his luck in the Australian colonies, where he hoped to prosper, as he had not done at the bar in Ireland. Leaving England's shores, Glynn noted in his diary his poor prospects at the bar in Dublin, where he had hoped to make a living, only to encounter an empty brief bag. He wrote, "The ills of the flesh are sometimes experienced in the stomach. In Ireland, energy and ability are only one of the prerequisites for professional success. I shake hands with the past and take my hat off to the future." Glynn, like many an Irishman of his day, walked two worlds, Catholic and Protestant. The Catholic one had nurtured and guided him from childhood, albeit a middle-class one from the hard-earned success of his family of West Coast merchants in the town of Gort. Surviving amid the destitution of many, this upbringing had instilled in Glynn a collective memory of prejudice, repression and struggle. From his Catholic background, Glynn inherited perseverance and the courage of tribal loyalty. But the Protestant world of British political and literary traditions would give Glynn his intellectual ambition, a path to success, and many of the principles and heroes he lived by. Milton, Shakespeare, Burke, Carlyle, Mill, De Quincey, Chatham, and so on. His hero for political style and thought was undoubtedly Edmund Burke. Assessing the men of the Federation Assemblies, Protestant Alfred Deakin wrote that Glynn was, if not the best read man of the convention, I believe he didn't believe that, Glynn certainly carried more English prose and poetry in his memory than any three or four of his associates, all being very vain. Deakin had to say, well, some of you may not agree, but I'm sure Alfred Deakin was astounded by his reading. A colleague, also Protestant, Robert Garran, concurred, writing that Glynn had a prodigious memory and was a fine speaker who shown signs of careful preparation. There was a little bit of the limited praise there from Garran, who probably didn't want to be outshone by an Irishman. But Deakin, commenting on Glynn further on, put it more astutely than Garran, writing, "Glynn, with greater assiduity of research, splendid and carefully polished diction and stiff delivery, never caught or kept the ear of an assembly, like all popular bodies, jealous and antagonistic to scholarship and style, unless forced upon them by more practical merits." Throughout the tough days of Glynn's first couple of years in Australia, his reading held him strong. Of Christmas Day 1881, he recorded, "I spent the day in the botanical gardens reading my constant companion, Shakespeare." Glynn arrived in Australia with letters of introduction to some of Melbourne's leading legal and political figures. For all that, he did not find an opening in the law, and for quite some time found himself needing to pawn his few valuable possessions, at one stage taken to the road unsuccessfully, selling life insurance. Ironically, Glynn's break, when it came, was thanks to his aunt, unsurprising connection here, Mother Bernard Walsh of the Sisters of St. Joseph, who was able to advance his cause in mid-1882 by recommending him to an Adelaide firm of lawyers wanting to open an office in Kapunda, a mining pastoral town 80 kilometres north. They wanted a Catholic lawyer. Glynn got the job. Over the next two decades, Paddy Glynn would steadily make his name as lawyer, newspaper editor, public speaker and politician. It was a hard climb financially, but Glynn remained positive, spending more time riding his horses than meeting pretty young women at dances. As he explained in a letter to his mother, his enduring interest was in the public debate, and this tells you a lot about what kept him going. He wrote, "We have a big public dance once a fortnight, a lawn tennis club, private parties, etc., and a general air of smartness in everything compared to a provincial town at home. However, these are things I reckon very little. As long as I think that I might have beaten a few fools in a bigger sphere of action, I can never remain quiet." Appointed editor of the Kapunda Herald in April 1883, a position he held alongside his legal work until 1891, Glidden was rarely silent. His leaders in the Herald attracted attention in Adelaide, and he soon became a recognised public figure, giving talks on matters of interest from the arts to big and new ideas around land management. In 1884, he wrote the 176-page manifesto for the South Australian Land Nationalisation Society, and he had become a supporter of American economist Henry George, who had popularised the idea of a tax on the unimproved value of land. In the manifesto, Glynn opined, "About 1.25 million acres of the best agricultural land in South Australia, situated within the line of rainfall, is at present owned by about 30 persons. It seems unjust on the face of it that population should be driven to settle upon the arid plains to the north while such vast tracts of suitable country nearer home are not put to their proper uses." Now, the proper uses Glynn referred to were small farming for agricultural purposes, not grazing. He wanted a redistribution of land so that a few pastoralists no longer had a monopoly. It was revolutionary stuff. Yet there are echoes in Glynn today of both the Coalition and Labor's policies to help first home buyers enter the housing market. Land and its distribution have been at the heart of Australia's development over the centuries, and you can find this in the acts of selection in the 19th century down to Bob Santamaria's ideas for rural Australia. Glynn both won and lost on the back of his public stand on land. He entered South Australian Parliament as an MP in 1897, only to lose his seat in 1890. After moving his practice to Adelaide, he then won North Adelaide in a by-election in 1895, lost the seat in 1896, regained it in a by-election in 1897, and that year he was also elected as one of 10 delegates from South Australia to sit at the Australasian Federal Conventions. He was elected to the Federal Parliament in South Australia's statewide poll in March 1901, and in 1903 was returned for the new seat of Angus, which he held until 1919. Glynn was a supporter of George Read's Free Traders, but was given his first portfolio as Attorney General in Alfred Deakin's Fusion Ministry in 1909. He was Minister for External Affairs in Joseph Cook's Liberal government and Minister for Home Territories in the Hughes government from 1917. Paddy Glynn, however, was a very independent thinker and never entirely a party man. Irish-born Glynn carried no alienation in his identity as a citizen of the British Empire. From his approach to home rule for Ireland to his aspirations for the emerging Commonwealth of Australia, his support for the Crown was unambiguous, all of which he in time endeared him to a majority of his political colleagues. His position on solutions for Irish home rule backed Ireland being part of the United Kingdom as part of a federation, and he condemned Sir Roger Casement for his role in the Easter Rising of 1916. Glynn's seductive eloquence made its mark in the first days of the Adelaide Convention, alongside his erudition and wealth of knowledge. A cameo picture of Glynn at that constitutional convention was recorded in Sydney's Daily Telegraph on the 25th of March 1897, some of which I'll read to you. "From right away at the back benches, a diminutive figure in a brown tweed suit and a light blue necktie sprang up and caught the President's attention. This was Mr. Glynn. In a few seconds, he had drenched the convention in a torrent of words. He contemptuously dashed aside the fears expressed by Sir Richard Baker as to the system of responsible government under federation and quoted learned authorities who had an implicit belief in genesis of the English system. Mr. Glynn had volumes, documents, papers and reports, and from one he travelled to another. He quoted extensively. He threw masses of statistics at the representatives. He went to the United States, to Germany, to Austria. Words still poured out in a continuous and magnificent stream. Mr. Glynn took his seat amid general cheering." Sadly for students of Australian history, a study of the coming together at Federation of the American Australian colonies is not so exciting as those colonies of America, where a bloody war saw their independence from Britain and the birth of a federal constitution in the colourful heat of battle. Yet the achievement of the Australasian Conventions in the late 1890s and the energy of the debates was charged with the confidence of a young and proud people ready to take the plunge. A mix of liberalism and conservatism drove Glynn. He was with the majority in thinking that competition from cheap Pacific Kanaka and Asian Chinese labour would only degrade the wages of the colonies. Yet in his editorials and words at the conventions and in the federal parliament later on, he gave voice to the consideration of the rights of Chinese wanting to settle in the colonies. In the move to federate the colonies, Glynn saw free trade as an imperative, arguing federation without intercolonial free trade would be an anomaly. The case for free trade would not be won for many decades after Glynn's death, yet free trade between the states had succeeded in the coming together of the colonies to federation. In the early years of federation, Glynn wrote and published pamphlets opposing even imperial trade preference. In his years as a colonial MP, Glynn supported payment for members of parliament, female suffrage, and reform of the upper house, which aligned him with the more liberal or progressive side of politics. In his 1899 campaign for the South Australian seat of North Adelaide, one of his strongest supporters and campaigners was the leading suffragist, Catherine Spence. In his years as a federal MP, Glynn was often praised for the advice he gave MPs on all sides of the debates. His foresight and argument for a single-gauge railway track across the former colonies did not succeed, but he played a key role over two decades in bringing about the River Murray's Water Agreement of 1915, its locks and storage facilities ensuring navigation of the river for trade in South Australia from Wentworth at the Murray-Darling Junction to farmers and others downstream. Glynn would have been stunned to think that his advocacy for South Australia's water rights would have echoes a century later. We're still arguing about it. By far the best-known contribution from Glynn in the Constitutional Convention debates was his success in getting the final convention to include a reference to God in the preamble to the constitutional document sent to Britain for acceptance as an act of the British Parliament in setting up the Federation. A copy of his handwritten note is in the archives, and there's a copy on the cover under on his picture. The debate over the reference to God in the preamble was intense and opposed by prominent delegates such as Edmund Barton and Henry Bourne Higgins. Their argument was principally that any reference to God in the federal constitution threatened the rights of states to have sole jurisdiction over laws relating to religion. These delegates merely wished to preserve the separation of church and state as in the American constitution. Glynn himself, no pedantic or pious Christian, however, saw the words Almighty God as a non-sectarian presence guiding the hands of men in a powerful and precious moment. The words written by Glynn and accepted by the final convention in Melbourne, humbly relying on the blessing of Almighty God, while accepted without a vote, provoked Higgins to push for a further amendment to protect against any federal involvement in laws relating to religion. Ring a bell? The amendment would go on to form the basis of Section 116 of the Constitution, which reads, "The Commonwealth shall not make any law for establishing any religion, or for imposing any religious observance, or for prohibiting the free exercise of any religion, and no religious test shall be required as a qualification for any office or public trust under the Commonwealth." But for all that, religious freedom and its implications for our federal government are issues that remain today. There was never any doubt that Glynn identified as an Irish Catholic, but as he often remarked during the divisions over Ireland during 1916-18 and the First World War, thousands of Irish had joined up and were fighting in France. As Australians divided bitterly over conscription, Glynn remained strong in support of the war effort. Yet as a minister in the Hughes government, Glynn would join the campaign, that's the Hughes government after he split with the Labor Party, which eventually included maritime unionists to try to prevent the 1920 deportation of German-born Catholic priest Father Charles Jurger, who had been falsely accused in 1916 of making seditious statements during a Sunday sermon. Letters in the archives show Glynn argued strongly over some years against his own ministerial colleagues seeking to have the injustice of the Jager case resolved in Jager's favour. The campaign would fail and Glynn would lose his seat in 1919. A century and more later, matters that Glynn drew attention to continue. The Murray-Darling Basin, our place in the east-west divide, the need to find ways to a more equitable distribution and collection of tax, how to answer bigotry and mob pressure in the social fabric, Section 116 of the Constitution and freedom of religion, and an eternal question, whether increasing secularisation and materialism should or can hold a nation together. In any debate about Australia's future identity, Patrick McMahon Glynn deserves a resurrecting for scholarly consideration. For his life, for his inspiration, for his intellectual heroes, and for his ideas. Thank you.
Many thanks to Greg Craven and to Anne Henderson. Now, we've got some copies for sale of Federation's Man of Letters, Patrick McMahon Glynn, by Anne Henderson. It's got some strong endorsements from New South Wales Governor Margaret Beasley, from former High Court Chief Justice Murray Gleeson, and former Labor Premier of New South Wales Bob Carr, as well as the various comments in the book by, as the Vice Chancellor pointed out, Patrick Mullins, Anne Toomey, Susan Rutland, Peter Boyce, and John Fay. And there'll be copies for sale later, and I'm sure the author and the Vice Chancellor will be happy to sign it. So we come to question and discussion. We'll get you both up here. Greg, if you stay on that side, Anne, if you come on this side. Just leading off, as you know, anti-Catholic sectarianism was very strong in Australia at the turn of the 20th century. Glynn's an Irishman. The Irish are strong in New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, not at all in South Australia. And yet this man, who's Catholic Irish in a very Protestant state like South Australia, or colony that became a state like South Australia, gets a nomination for what was then called, I guess, the non-Labour side of Australian politics. So was that an exception, or was there no rule?
I'll start. There certainly was sectarian divisions, but not probably as bad as they became after the First World War, in the period of the latter part of the war and into the 20s and 30s. Patrick McMahon-Glynn was a strong supporter of the British Crown. And there were, in those times, obviously, from those who went to the war from Southern Ireland, many Irish who were actually Redmanites. If Paddy Glynn was anything, he was a Redmanite. And if you remember Irish history, Redmond wanted and had got an agreement just before the First World War that Ireland would be given home rule, much like Wales now and Scotland or Northern Ireland, but they would continue to sit in Westminster and be part of the British collective. And, of course, that all fell apart after the Easter Uprising in Dublin. Now, Paddy Glynn was obviously, as the Vice-Chancellor said, a charming man. He was a non-sectarian kind of person. He got on with people. He'd studied in the Inns of Court in London. He had been to Trinity College Dublin, which wasn't exactly a Catholic university in those days. He was an educated person who spoke the language of other educated people, whether they were Catholic or non-Catholic. And he impressed people by his ability to engage. But he got his job, his very first job, because he was a Catholic lawyer, through the help of his aunt, who was a very much a humble nun. So he obviously stretched beyond his tribal roots. And as you watch what he supported and what his ideas were, you could see that people followed him regardless of his background. But then I find in Australia, if you're the sort of person he was, if you're a genuinely engaging person, whether you're an Afghani or a Vietnamese or a Chinese, whatever, I think Australia gives you a fair go, and I think that was his achievement as well.
Rick? Look, I think that's right. I think we have to remember that Redmondism was actually the natural direction of evolution of Ireland. And if you hadn't had World War One, you hadn't had the 16, all of those sort of things. Basically, in the election, I think, before the 16, Redmond swept the Irish landscape. In the election afterwards, he was annihilated. People don't remember that Daniel Mannix, when he was the rector at Maynooth, I think it was Edward VII, he welcomed to Maynooth, and there was a lot of criticism of him for being excessively monarchist. I think one of the things with Glynn, it was that point I made about the paradox of empire. Glynn always remained very clearly that he was an Irish Catholic. He also understood that the opportunities that had been given to him in Australia had been given within that same empire. And I think that allowed him to... That and the fact, as Anne said, I mean, he just was a very likeable person, unlike poor Isaac Isaac.
Can I just add one thing? That the person over the last few days talking with Jared that we've come to think was closest to Patrick McMahon-Glynn in terms of his success in politics was Joseph Lyons. Joseph Lyons was a man of faith. He didn't have to profess it, though. He never did. He never carried it on his sleeve. But he got on very well with ordinary people. And when they won the election in 1937, he literally dragged the party back over the line, a bit like ScoMo. But you had this Catholic figure in Lyons in the middle of fairly sectarian times getting a huge vote in 1931, and half the Catholic vote went with it, with the Conservatives. That helped, of course. But he maintained his hold on government in spite of being the Catholic and from the minority group, and everyone knew he in Alliance for Catholics. And that's the same with Paddy Glynn. He had an electorate which was made up a lot of the time of Lutheran Germans. And some of the time, some of the things he was on land, for example, didn't quite mix with their views. But something about his personality took him over the line.
A question here.
Thank you so much for joining us and this lovely launch of a beautiful book. The times that were spent leading up to Federation, when all the states were encouraged to be part of this, did Mr. Glynn have any part in encouraging New Zealanders and Western Australians to join earlier in the peace, or was that not a part of the agenda?
I don't know about New Zealand. I know he had a fairly strong view on Western Australia. In fact, one of the reasons I'm so fond of Patrick McMahon Glynn is that I was idiot enough when very young to choose as the topic for my thesis whether an Australian state could secede. Now, that's very obscure. Not a lot of time was spent talking about that at the conventions, but Paddy Glynn spent a lot of time talking about it because he had that sort of mind that actually went to fundamental questions. And so he could actually see that getting the colonies to federate was all very well, but if 10 years later they fell apart, then Australia had never existed. And again, I think Anne's right. I mean, he was prescient. One of the other things we've gotten is that in the 1930s, Western Australia made the most determined attempt to secede. And at that time, a number of other states were watching where it was going. So he was certainly very interested in the idea, I think, of a continental Australia. He understood that, and his interest in defence, I think, correlated very strongly with that.
I'll just add that I think there was a moment when Reid, after I think we'd formed Federation, used Paddy Glynn to persuade some of the West Australians on some of the issues that were dividing the new Parliament. So he obviously, being in South Australia and closest to West Australia, Reid being his sort of group leader, saw that he had some impact, he could have some impact on the West Australians, but of course nobody could bring them in until that final vote. Yeah. They were not present at the conventions.
There's a question here.
Yes, Vice-Chancellor and Anne,
I'm
fabulously interested in that book, which I'll buy. What I want to know is this, that there's a critical part in the Constitution, and I want to know Ms. Glynn's role in this, that says that brought WA and Queensland in at the last minute, which says that if a referendum is held and the rest of the country says yes, but Queensland and or WA say no, they have the right to leave the Commonwealth. Now, it is there in black and white, and it is quite profound, because if you think of the number of issues that now may go to a referendum or could, it is still there, which would allow WA and Queensland to leave.
Okay.
That was operative during the referendum on the Republic issue.
Greg, I think you might address that.
I think so.
Look, in fact, there isn't a provision that quite does that. There's certainly provisions which say that in relation to certain matters relating to a state in a referendum, unless the people of that state agree, for example, reduction of their representation in the parliament, then that referendum does not become operative. So it gives a veto. Actually gives a veto to any state, but you have to remember Western Australia was a very small state when it came in, so that was important to them. In fact, there isn't a right to secede, which is what you're talking about in the Australian Constitution. There isn't. In fact, I wrote 230 pages of extremely boring text proving that that was not the case. What is interesting is that in Australia we have had attempts to secede, and Western Australia did assert a right to secede and actually took its case before a joint parliamentary committee of the House of Commons and the Lords in the 1930s. And the truth is, the only reason I think that Western Australia did not secede, well, there were two reasons. One was that by the time that they had managed to get their petition up, things had gone from 1930 to 1935, and we were worried about a lot more than the price of grain from Western Australia. The other was that once the Commonwealth had finished presenting its case, formal hearing, QC, the QC sat down and got what legal members here will know is called the tug, where your client pulls you, and he whispered something, and a rather white-faced QC stood up and said, "My lords, I am commanded to say that should the petition of the State of Western Australia to secede from the Commonwealth of Australia be received by either house of this Parliament, events will occur in Australia that will shatter the empire to its very foundations." The empire took the hint.
There's a question here.
Professor Craven, you mentioned Isaacs a couple of times. I just wondered whether Lynn made any comments about Isaacs' role as Justice of the High Court. And particularly with the engineer's case, and if he didn't, could you speculate on what he might have said?
Well, I think that's a bit difficult.
That is a bit difficult. I mean, that they were very, very different people. They were very similar. They were autodidacts and all of those sorts of things. But Glynn was a brilliant, and Isaacs was difficult. I think it would be fair to say Glynn was...
I haven't seen anything.
Now, Glynn was a Federalist. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, you come from South Australia, you're going to be a Federalist. I can't remember him saying anything about the engineer's case. I'm happy to say it's crap. But I'm not channeling.
By the time of the engineer's case,
By
the time of the engineer's case,
Glynn, which is 1920, right?
Yeah, well, he's dead. Yeah. But if it was, there was a couple just before. There were two or three, or I can't remember. But 1919's in my head. He was a very frail man by 1918. I mean, he had dementia. Oh, sorry, he lost his. Oh, I'm wrong. He died in 31. By 1919, he's out of politics, and there's nothing really there.
And sorry, you might just get.
He died in 31. I just got my dates from my book.
But you might add, he does behave, it was in your book, he does behave in a way that indicates that he's not...
Oh, as he got older and retired and after his wife died, he did become, you know, very frail. So I think by the time, after he lost his... He did some things for Father Jager after he lost his seat. He was still on the case. But he did some law, he did some appearances in the High Court, but really his political career, once it was over, he became a much quieter individual.
Question. There's a question up the back there. Okay, just wanted you to see the camera before you move. Jeremy.
Thank you. Jared, Anne and Greg, I might need some help here. A few months ago, there was a launch of a book, and I think is it Patricia or the Bible and Christianity in Australia. I'm not sure whether she's spoken or is going to speak at the Sydney Institute or has already, but she was one of the essential themes of that book was the failure to acknowledge the importance of religion and those who were advocating the new constitution who came from a religious belief. Could you comment, were there many who were secular or in fact atheists or who actually were against, even given the section 116 point, who are actually against that? And second question allied to that is, do you think that's why there's been a turning against religion so much nowadays, and even starting in the 60s, where, if I can quote from page 117, although typical of the club, it said, Doon's membership criterion was paraphrased as, quote, no Jews, jockeys or Catholics, and whether the antithesis of religion or the anti-religious feeling is so evident nowadays because of a reaction to the way it was so strong in the formation of our federation.
Okay, so the question is the current attitude to religion these days, which is the implications is increasingly hostility to it, somehow relate to what happened back at the time of federation?
All I want to say is that I'm not sure that religion was so strong with the Founding Fathers, because the first time Paddy Glynn put up the notion of having a reference to God in the Act, or the bill that was going to the Parliament, it was knocked out. And, there were a few New South Wales politicians that would have supported him that weren't there for the vote. But there was quite a lot of hostility among the Founding Fathers to having any reference to God. And people like Barton and Henry Bournes Higgins and others spoke out very strongly. But the reason it came back was because the silent Australians, so we weren't so silent, in the churches rallied around, and Glyn was accused in a rather sectarian way of being the little Irish character who'd put up this motion and got it knocked down, hadn't planned it. Well, the point was the churches hadn't done anything either. Now, the churches were much stronger then, but they also had a vote, all those people, and they made it clear between one year and the next that if this was going to pass in a referendum, it was going to have a reference to God somewhere in it, or the churches would tell all their followers to vote it down. So it was kind of a silent Australian campaign, and not a very religious one. They just, that was their side of politics, and they wanted it to have a say, but only because the Founding Fathers had actually voted it down.
And can I just say, the Founding Fathers in terms of religion are much more various than people think. So, I mean, Anne's quite right. God knows what Barton believed, because he certainly wasn't particularly religious. The same thing could be said of Charles Cameron Kingston. Deacon, of course, himself notoriously was a spiritualist, so it was a very, very complex position. I mean, there are two other things. One is there is that rather dismissive thing that, you know, the reason that Glyn, and I think Leno says this in his history, the reason that Glyn, in a sense, was picked to put the thing up was not only because of his interests, but was, the joke is, he was the only one of the Founding Fathers who could be reliably supposed to actually believe in God. Now, that's a great exaggeration, but there's a humorous thing in it. So, and the other thing, of course, is part of that silent majority that was not so silent were these ferocious Protestant women's temperance unions. And ideally, I think they would have liked prohibition of alcohol, but failing that, they were prepared to settle for God. And that was one of the reasons that it got up.
He drank wine.
There's a question here.
I love Professor Craven's comment that he's a man of nuance and a successful politician. If only we were able to have nuance and successful politics these days. But that's not my question. My question is about Glyn forecasting a time when England would walk back on its need to defend the Pacific Territories, which surely would have been at a time when the English Navy was seen as ruling the waves and really governing the world. And certainly, I presume at that point would not have been after the disasters of the Great War. So what led him to predict that, and how was it received at the time, and was any action ever taken, or was it just seen as a peculiarity?
Glyn was an amazing thinker. He did read more than anyone at the convention. I mean, he was literally saved by his reading. It was an addiction. He gave up alcohol at some point, and his books he never gave up. He read the overseas newspapers that his family kept sending out to him from Europe, from England and Ireland. He thought outside the square. I guess that's why he took up land nationalisation because it was a kind of moment in time that the idea suddenly caught fire, and a lot of people thought, new idea, great idea, but it didn't go that far. But there's so many things. Like, he supported the White Australia policy because, quite rightly, and this has happened in America with illegal immigration, if you have a huge number of people coming into your country and they can be given, servile wages well under the idea of a good wage, like the Latin Americans in America, the Chinese perhaps in Australia we were thought to be wanting to surge in, it does bring wages down. That's why in America wages are very low for ordinary unskilled workers. So he was a supporter of the White Australia policy, but he spoke up in his editorials in the Kapunda Herald and in the Parliament again and again, right into Federal Times, of the need to consider the wives and children and rights of Chinese who were settled here. And he also produced statistics to show that this mania about the idea the Chinese were swamping us, Pauline Hanson, good one here, the idea that they were swamping us, he was constantly showing that after the gold rushes, when there was no gold to find, the actual number of Chinese wanting to come to Australia had gone way, way down. Now, the Kanakas were another story. But he was one of these people that thought outside the square. And I was surprised as any to find that quote, but it is a very far-sighted thinking, and that's Patrick McMahon-Glyn.
Now, the question we have is on his international and other outlook, and Anne's made a comment. this can be, I think, the final comment.
Sure.
Because we're running on to
talk. One of the things I'd say, he was part of that remarkable generation. Remember that another member of that remarkable generation, Alfred Deakin, very different to Glyn, but who had a high opinion of Glyn, was the man who decided that there was going to be an Australian Navy. Now, that was an astonishing, certainly astonished the British, who'd always thought that what would happen was that Australia would pay for the upkeep of British warships on the Australian station. Now, that's quite connected. And the other thing I just say, the final thing I'll say, just on his reading, it's absolutely right. He was a prodigious reader, and I remember one of the rare occasions when I've had a conversation sort of about Patrick McMahon Glyn with a federal politician in the last 20 years, and I was disagreeing with him very strongly about something here as a Liberal. I said, look, I really think you need to go back to Burke on this. And he said, and I quote, "What Don?" We've gone a long way backwards. A long way backwards.
Many thanks to Anne Henderson and to Professor Greg Craven for a lively discussion. I'll just make one brief final point. It's interesting that Patrick McMahon Glyn has been revived by originally Gerald O'Collins, Melbourne-based, as I recall, and now from people at the PM Glyn Institute at the Australian National University, essentially based in Sydney and in Melbourne and other places as well. But he's not so much recognised in South Australia, although he was the most prominent people in the early part of the 20th century from there. So maybe it's time to sort of take a train to Kapunda. Kapunda. I'm sorry, he's our South Australian. Kapunda. Thank you, Jacqueline. So, as I said, there are copies of Federation Man of Letters there today. It was a fine book, and I'm sure the author and the Vice Chancellor would be happy to sign. But for today, thanks for a lively presentation and a very thoughtful 1 hour. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.